Welcome to AJHP Voices, a series of discussions with AJHP authors and interviews focused on contemporary practice issues. AJHP is the official journal of ASHP, and its mission is to advance science, pharmacy practice, and health outcomes.
Hi, this is Daniel Kobah, the editor-in-chief of AJHP. Thanks for joining us for this episode of AJHP Voices. Methadone has long played an essential role in the treatment of people with opioid use disorder. Historically, restrictions under U.S. federal law have prohibited prescribing methadone for OUD treatment upon discharge from the emergency department or the hospital. But in August 2023, the Drug Enforcement Administration expanded access to medications for opioid use disorder. Joining me today to discuss their approach to implementing a novel process for dispensing methadone in two hospitals in the Johns Hopkins Health System are Dr. Lindsay Bowman, Clinical Pharmacy Specialist, Addiction Medicine, Dr. Suzanne Nesbitt, Clinical Pharmacy Specialist, Pain Management, and Dr. Olivia Berger, Clinical Pharmacy Specialist, Pain and Palliative Care. Lindsay, Suzanne, Olivia, welcome. Lindsay, as we start off, can you remind us of what the historic DEA regulations allowed and did not allow related to the use of methadone upon a hospital or ED discharge for people with OUD?
So DEA regulations require that practitioners be separately registered as an opioid treatment program in order to dispense methadone for the treatment of opioid use disorder or opioid withdrawal outside of the hospital. I think important to note that this does not preclude methadone administration for opioid use disorder or opioid withdrawal in the hospital when patients are admitted for conditions other than opioid addiction, but it does come into play when discharge planning because next day dosing at an opioid treatment program is then necessary. I think the difficult piece is that most opioid treatment programs or OTPs have pretty limited hours. Many are open only during early morning hours and often are closed on weekends or on holidays. And intake hours for patients who are newly starting on methadone are even more limited. So it was very common for a hospitalized patient who was otherwise medically ready for discharge on a Friday, for instance, to need to remain in the hospital for an additional 2 to 3 days until next day dosing at an opioid treatment program could be arranged.
So that's the way things were historically. But things began to change then in March of 2022. At that point, the DEA began recognizing some exceptions to the rule. Can you walk us through those and what that looked like?
Yeah, so this actually came at the direction of Congress. Initially, the call to action came in 2020 from Congress. And then, as you said, in March of 2022, the DEA began allowing hospitals, emergency departments, and clinics to apply for an exception, which would allow those institutions to dispense up to a 3-day supply of methadone at one time for the treatment of opioid use disorder. And this was meant to be a bridge to ongoing treatment at an opioid treatment program. I think it's critical to highlight that it allowed the dispensing of methadone and not the prescribing of methadone. But again, it was up to a 3-day supply at one time.
Got it. Now, Suzanne, when that exception occurred in March of 2022, when that was allowed, the first step that Johns Hopkins took in its approach was seeking DEA authorization for an exception. How onerous was that at the time?
Thanks for the question, Dan. It actually wasn't that onerous, and I would have to say we were a little surprised by that. When we reached out to the DEA, they required a letter from the institution, and we generated that from the Department of Pharmacy requesting the exception, and we needed to include our hospital DEA number. So we also got clearance from our vice president for medical affairs, and that's really all it entailed. And they allowed a 1-year exception. Now, it has even gotten easier because as of August of 2023, the DEA actually took the language that they released in March of 22 and codified it. So now it's in regulation. And now hospitals, EDs, clinics do not even have to request the exception. It's codified by law.
And as we're going to start to talk about some of the details of the program that you established at Johns Hopkins, It would seem to me with that August 2023 change in the law that there's probably even more opportunity for other organizations to do what you've done and use your AJHP article as a guide in some ways. Is that fair to say, Suzanne?
Yes, that's exactly right. And we are hoping our article really allows people to think about this, particularly our health systems, and really provide this opportunity for patients to go home with methadone dispensed by the inpatient pharmacies.
So with that in mind, Olivia, one of the first things that the team at Johns Hopkins did was you established a work group to guide implementation as you implemented a service to dispense, as Lindsay really emphasized, dispensing methadone upon discharge. What did that work group look like? Who were the members of the team?
So like Suzanne said, as we were initially waiting to hear back about the exception, we formed a multidisciplinary work group. We knew that it would be important to ensure that we had representation from many different stakeholders from both hospitals, as this was going to be a pretty big undertaking and implementation was going to happen simultaneously at both locations. So the foundation of the work group was made up of providers and pharmacists. Our provider representation included the directors of the respective addiction medicine consult services, an emergency department physician from each hospital, and then one hospital-affiliated opioid treatment program director, as we felt their insight on methadone dispensing would certainly be invaluable. Our pharmacy representation was significant, as pharmacists were essential to implementing this new workflow. And pharmacy representation included pharmacists on the inpatient addiction medicine consult services, pharmacy leadership, including our director of clinical services and inpatient pharmacy operations managers, as well as, of course, Suzanne, who has the added area of expertise from an opioid stewardship perspective. Other key collaborators also joined the work group throughout the process. This included our clinical informatics team, legal and regulatory representatives from the hospitals, nursing, and then outpatient pharmacy leadership as well.
It was really notable to me as I read your article again in preparation for our conversation today, that the depth of pharmacy expertise and participation that was there to really cover each of the areas that would need to be deployed to make this an effective program. What did the work group focus on?
Great question. So our work group had several goals, which first definitely included the development of the inpatient workflow for requesting, approving, and dispensing the methadone supply. Another goal of the work group was to identify and build tools within our electronic health record that would support the workflow and the related necessary documentation for the process. And then lastly, the work group also developed education materials for the ultimate end users of the workflow, which would be, for example, primary teams throughout the hospitals, pharmacy, and nursing as well. And I can also share that to accomplish these goals, this work group met virtually since we had people from two different sites involved for about an hour each week for almost about 6 months. And then after our go live, we continued to meet every other week to continue discussing just process improvement and possible expansion as well.
Lindsay, early on, there was actually a decision to focus on methadone and not include buprenorphine, for example, as part of the process. What drove that decision?
I think it was two things. Probably most significantly, access to buprenorphine has expanded quite a bit with the removal of the X waiver requirement. And so we were really not finding that delayed access to buprenorphine was affecting time to discharge or complicating connection to care in the community the way that methadone really consistently was. The other thing is that dispensing buprenorphine is not nearly as complex, right? So buprenorphine bridge prescriptions can be written by primary medical teams in the hospital or by providers on our addiction consult services and dispensed in the traditional way from our outpatient pharmacy, whereas methadone is complicated, right? As we highlighted earlier, the law prohibits prescribing methadone. It really can just be dispensed, which indicated to us that we were going to need a bit of a more innovative pathway to dispense this medication. And so that's why we focused really specifically on methadone.
Well, that innovative pathway, that's a great segue into my next question. Suzanne, Olivia has talked about the work group composition and the focus, and then Lindsay's talked about why methadone. In the article, you outline three key steps that include a number of safeguards involved in the implementation process. The first was establishment of eligibility criteria. Could you walk us through those key steps?
Sure. So as you mentioned, step one was really the determination of need and the initial request from the primary team caring for the patient. We felt it was important within this first step to really establish criteria for the patients. And first off, the patient really should have a diagnosis of moderate to severe OUD or opioid use disorder. So that's the patient population. The second criteria, which is really essentially important, is that the patient either is currently enrolled in an OTP or opioid treatment program within the community, because again, we can only dispense up to 3 doses. So there has to be a plan for the patient. Either they're returning to the OTP that they had previously been involved with, or we require that there's already an intake appointment made for a program for that patient prior to us dispensing this methadone. And then the last criteria for this initial step was that patients are unable to present at the OTP in a timely fashion. And initially, Lindsay walked us through some of those challenges in terms of limited time frames by which the OTPs are open, even during the week, but often on weekends and holidays, they are not available and open. So we really felt the targeted time to discharge would be, you know, as we approach a weekend or a holiday weekend in particular, that patients might be discharged on a Friday, but not be able to receive methadone from an OTP until a Monday.
Lindsay, part of really the overall approach included something I thought was very unique, was the methadone for home order set. What does that order set include?
So it's a bit of a complex order set, because this pathway was a new one where we're dispensing a medication intended for outpatient use from our inpatient pharmacy. Fortunately, we do have a few other medications here at Hopkins that we process in that way. And so we use that as sort of a building point to inform building of this order set. And in the order set, we really have 3 key parts. So the first is an inpatient order for the methadone. This is used for the pharmacist's review and verification of the order, and then it allows us to print out labels for the outpatient doses and physically dispense the medication. A couple of key points about the inpatient order is that first, we clearly marked in the name of the order that it was intended for outpatient use, so that was abundantly clear for nursing that this is not meant to be administered in the hospital. And then also we built the inpatient order so that it would not show up on the medication administration record or the MAR. Again, that was a safety parameter to make sure that this is not administered inadvertently in the hospital. The second part to the order set is an outpatient order. And this isn't a real prescription. It doesn't actually go to any pharmacy. The reason it exists is because it allows us to populate the discharge paperwork with some information about the methadone, specifically what dose and how many doses were dispensed to the patient. And patients are instructed to bring that paperwork with them to their opioid treatment program so that we have a means of communicating what was given to the patient. It also includes a reminder for nursing to physically hand those doses of methadone to the patient at the time of discharge. And then the final part of the order set is the approval request. And so this is a place, it's built actually as a consult order in Epic, and it includes a number of questions about the request that will be used for the reviewers when they're deciding whether or not to grant approval.
As I read about the approval process from designated providers at Johns Hopkins, actually one of the things that jumped out to me was that it really was an indicator of the overall organizational commitment to this program. When you look at what the emergency physicians, for example, have committed to, can you talk about that approval process and how it differs on the inpatient side versus in the ED?
Absolutely. Yeah. So on the inpatient side, we have addiction medicine providers at both institutions who have plenty of expertise in using methadone to treat opioid use disorder, as well as intimate knowledge of methadone programs in the area where follow-up can be arranged. These are the individuals on the inpatient side who are providing review and approval of the methadone bridge dosing requests. And those individuals are available 7 days a week during standard business hours, so 8 to 4:30, give or take a few hours. In the ED, the difference is that theoretically we could receive requests for methadone bridge dosing 24 hours a day, and our inpatient providers just don't have that same availability. So we were really fortunate to identify a few providers that would be kind of physician champions for this effort in the ED who have some addiction experience, who are accustomed to offering methadone for treatment of opioid use disorder. And so those are the individuals that were providing review and approval for ED requests in a broader timeframe. Both inpatient and ED approvers are supported by a team of peer recovery specialists at both institutions. Those are people with lived experience in addiction who are now in sustained recovery, who are really intimately familiar with the methadone programs in the Maryland area and play a critical role in connecting patients to treatment, especially for patients newly started on methadone. And then I think the final piece that we've been able to leverage since the publication of our paper is actually incorporating clinical pharmacy specialists into the approval process at one of our hospitals. And so both on the inpatient side and in the ED, clinical pharmacy specialists are now granting approvals for these methadone requests, which has allowed us to provide a lot more efficiency in review and approval.
Talk about that a bit more, the now expanding to clinical pharmacy specialists. Were there steps that needed to be taken to enable that? Did that include credentialing and privileging within the health system? Were there any legal implications that needed to be addressed as well? Can you talk us through that?
Sure. So I think as far as credentialing and privileging, there were not any additional formal training in that sense that was necessary. You all kind of noted earlier in the discussion how intimately involved a number of pharmacists were throughout the process of creating this workflow, including myself and Olivia and Suzanne. So having had that intimate knowledge of how this program was generated and the goals of the program, it lended nicely into being able to support the approval process. I think the unique piece came in involving some of the ED specialists, because this was not necessarily something that was a part of their usual care. And so Suzanne and myself and other addiction clinical pharmacy specialists that I work with worked with our ED specialists to do a little bit of education and training there, and just walking them through what our approval process looks like, what pieces go into the review to make sure requests are appropriate, and a little bit of education in, you know, what opioid treatment programs are available in the community, just so that they could learn to recognize some of those names. But no additional legal ramifications that we had to think about, because we're not physically ordering the medication, just providing approval.
Now, Olivia, finally, the third step in the process that's outlined in the paper addresses drug preparation, dispensing, and delivery. How does the process differ from traditional approaches to dispensing medications for patients upon discharge?
That's a great question and also a complex question. So once the order has been officially placed and the approval has been received, like Lindsay described, our pharmacists in the inpatient pharmacies at both hospitals that are doing the standard order verification at each site are able to begin preparing and dispensing the methadone. So once the order is reviewed by the pharmacist has to manually dispense the number of doses that were approved, ensuring that they have one label per dose. So that's a little bit different than other dispensing practices. This could be, like we've talked about, up to 3 days worth of dosing. And since methadone for opioid use disorder is usually dosed once daily, this is likely going to be 1, 2, or 3 doses. Notably, these medication labels differ from our standard inpatient labels. Because these doses are being dispensed from the inpatient pharmacy but are ultimately for use outside of the hospital, the label that is printed actually satisfies requirements both at the state and federal level for outpatient prescription labeling. So that's really important. And then once the labels are printed, the pharmacist is able to vend the necessary amount of methadone following the hospital's controlled substance procedure and dispenses each dose in a separate tamper-evident oral liquid vial. Each vial contains one dose and each is individually labeled. Once those are prepared, the doses, whether it's one dose or three, the doses are placed into a tamper-evident bag to ensure safe storage. I will note, too, that we chose to utilize oral liquid methadone instead of methadone tablets because this practice more closely mirrors practice at our opioid treatment programs. And then delivery is also pretty different than usual delivery of inpatient medications. Either the nurse is able to pick this up from the pharmacy, or it is delivered to the unit to a secure lockbox where we are able to store other medications for discharge. Which process is followed kind of depends on the staffing resources at that time or at that location. So to summarize this process, while there are definitely some similarities to traditional inpatient dispensing, certainly has some steps that are unique to this workflow. And to ensure that our pharmacists have a clear process to follow, this has all been kind of typed up and documented in a stepwise fashion as a pharmacy department standard operating procedure.
And what about delivery to the ED?
So for the ED at both locations, they come to the pharmacy to pick up the methadone because they don't have the same capabilities with the lock boxes and things. So they're coming to pick it up and then taking it back to the patient.
And so, Olivia, what's the experience with the program been so far?
So our experience has definitely been mostly positive so far at both hospitals. It's been great to see the improvements that we've been able to make with transitions of care. I think as with any new workflow or service implementation, re-education for anyone who may be less familiar with the process or who just encounters it less frequently has certainly been necessary, but the education has been effective when needed for certain steps of the process. In particular, I think the ordering and approval process is something that we revisit often just to make sure that goes smoothly. And since our go live in November of 2022, we have used this workflow to dispense approximately 350 doses of methadone between both sites. So I would say the uptake has been significant and impactful for our patients.
Lindsay, with that thought in mind, 350 patients who have received their methadone this way, we know that there's evidence of providing methadone take-home doses can result in lower rates of treatment interruption and discontinuation. But what are the other benefits that are likely for those patients and future patients who can receive their methadone through a program like this?
I think we are very interested in investigating how this service has affected length of stay. Our hypothesis is that by avoiding the need to retain people in the hospital until methadone is accessible, this service will shorten length of stay and with that potentially result in significant cost savings for the hospital. Also, by mitigating potential disruptions in methadone treatment, which can have adverse health outcomes and result in repeat ED presentations and readmission to the hospital, we're also very interested in reviewing those specific outcomes in patients who have received bridge doses of methadone.
Suzanne, anything you would add to that?
I think overall, we're looking at not only as a department, but also as a health system, you know, really being able to ensure transitions of care and getting patients out of the hospital as early and safely as possible is really a strategic goal. So this particular initiative really has garnered the attention, not only of leadership within the Department of Pharmacy, but really across the organization as well, as an important service to our patients, to our community, but also within our strategic goals.
Suzanne, one of the other things that you talk about in the article is concerns about, you know, we know that there are concerns that there could be an increased risk of opioid overdose when methadone take-home rules are relaxed. This was something that was a concern during the pandemic. And I imagine that that's something that's been considered with this program as well. What steps are you taking to counter the risks associated with potential overdose?
Absolutely. It's always a concern. This initiative with methadone for home dispensing falls under our Greater Opiate Stewardship Initiative. So we certainly have other initiatives. And the other one that we have quite a large workflow and commitment to is naloxone distribution. So partnered with that, again, in the inpatient side and at the point of discharge and within the ED encounters with our patients, we are able to provide naloxone free of charge, the product in hand to our patients. We're able to do this by another initiative, which we have become an opioid response program within the state of Maryland. And so that allows us to procure naloxone free of charge and then be able to give it to our patients. So we have quite a robust program surrounding naloxone throughout our health system as well. And then as always, inpatient and particularly in the ED setting, we really also rely on our peer recovery coaches to engage with patients about other mitigation strategies as well.
It would seem, as we talked about earlier, that with the changes in the DEA's approach here, that now there's an opportunity for even more health systems to adopt a similar program. And I'm wondering, again, Suzanne, as you look back at this journey that you've been through, that you and Lindsay and Olivia and so many others at Hopkins have been through, how easy would it be for other hospitals and health systems to establish similar programs?
Well, it definitely was a journey, but having a great team to work on this really is important. And I think as health systems, certainly our article and our desire to publish our workflow was really to give other health systems the tools to be able to think about this and incorporate it. I think it's very important for pharmacists to take the lead on this. I think it's a great opportunity. It is a novel workflow for an inpatient pharmacy to think about dispensing a medication, particularly methadone, for homegoing. But it's such an important service to a very vulnerable patient population that we believe it's the right thing to do. I think many of our colleagues and other health systems will also feel it is an important patient care initiative to really offer. We are so committed to it. We continue to meet and work out the workflow for patients that are being discharged to post-acute facilities, so skilled nursing facilities or subacute rehab, which had some other items we had to address, particularly chain of custody. But we did implement that workflow, and that is also up and running as well. So it does take some effort. You need the right stakeholders, but it's an important service to provide our patients.
Lindsay, Suzanne made reference to some of the other settings that patients are discharged to from a hospital, including skilled nursing facilities, and then raised the issue of chain of custody for the methadone. Can you talk us through that a bit? What does that whole process look like?
Originally, when we went live with this new service, we were offering it strictly to patients who were discharging to community sites. Most commonly, that was home, but it might also include a substance use treatment program where there was a supportive housing component or perhaps a shelter. In those cases, we were dispensing methadone directly to the patient. And so it was in some ways similar to dispensing other medications directly to the patient. And chain of custody was not necessary beyond the typical chain of custody transferring between hospital locations. We had a big push from our hospital to be able to offer this service for patients going to post-acute care facilities. So like you mentioned, skilled nursing, subacute rehab. And that's because when patients who are on methadone go to those facilities, it requires a little bit of coordination at the facility to connect the patient to the methadone program so that doses can get delivered. And we were finding that patients who are treated with methadone had a hard time getting accepted to facilities because that coordination was so complex that it essentially had to happen as soon as they arrived at the facility, and that was difficult to arrange. And so the idea was that this new service where we could dispense patients with bridge doses would make that coordination a little simpler because facilities, subacute care facilities, would have a few days to arrange the intake process with the methadone program. What it meant for us in terms of our workflow was that we had to think about a new chain of custody process, right? Because unlike when we were dispensing directly to the patient, here we'd be potentially dispensing to another healthcare facility who would then be administering the methadone. So we had to think about a few key points. Number one, how are we getting the methadone over to the facility? Does it go, you know, we tossed around the idea of sending it by courier. We thought about sending it with the patient and transport over to the facility. And then we also had to think about how are we documenting those handoffs during the process because it's not as simple as handing it directly to the patient. Ultimately, we landed on, for our institution, what made the most sense was dispensing the methadone to transport personnel and having it transported along with the patient so that medication and patient arrived at the subacute care facility at the same time. And we created a chain of custody form that was signed then by transport and ultimately signed by the subacute care facility to document chain of custody. That's what made the most sense for our institution.
And that's all the time we have today. I want to thank Drs. Lindsay Bowman, Suzanne Nesbitt, and Olivia Berger for joining us to discuss their article, Operationalizing the New DEA Exception, a Novel Process for Dispensing of Methadone for Opioid Use Disorder at Discharge from Acute Care Settings, which was recently published on hhp.org. Please join us here each month for discussions on contemporary practice issues and interviews with HHP authors. If you enjoyed this podcast, please share it with your colleagues and via your social media of choice.
Thank you for listening to AJHP Voices. For more information about AJHP, the premier source for impactful, relevant, and cutting-edge professional and scientific content that drives optimal medication use and health outcomes, please visit ajhp.org.